And welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR News Station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Coming up on the program today, our film critic Dan Hudak finds out what's new at O Cinema from co-founder Kareem Tapsch. There's a new CD available from the incredible Miami Saxophone Quartet. Jazz writer Bob Weinberg speaks with quartet member, jazz musician, and educator Gary Lindsay. Chef Norman Van Aken presents a word on food, and Andy Newman tells us what's happening in the fabulous Florida Keys. The nonprofit Legal Arts' new incarnation is Cannonball, and it's quite an apt moniker. Adding to a long history of success, Cannonball hopes to bring fresh, vital support to South Florida's artists through arts advocacy and innovative programs. Founded in 2003, the organization's mission was to provide pro bono legal services to emerging artists. Since then, their mission has exploded to great proportions, offering a full list of legal programs and referrals, panel discussions, artist talks, workshops, and roundtable debates, all in the effort to help sustain long-lasting careers in the arts. Among other important innovations, in 2010, the organization established Miami's first live and work residency program offering affordable studio space. With us today to catch up on all of these important offerings for artists is Mr. Chris Cook, Executive Director of Cannonball. And welcome to South Florida Arts Beat, Chris.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here, Ed.
Great to meet you. And I'm so impressed with Cannonball. Let's go back. How did you all arrive at a new name?
Well, it started with us thinking about the context, our local context here in Miami. And we wanted a name that reflected Miami itself and specifically the pool culture here. And we also wanted a name that was fun, lighthearted, and really spoke to what we thought what important work, artwork really does. So if you can imagine yourself at a pool party and someone is doing a cannonball dive into the pool and you happen to be splashed, you know, it's fun, it makes you laugh, but it's also very disruptive. And we think important art is disruptive. It really dislodges you from your current state of consciousness, whether it be a painting, sculpture, a new piece of music. So that's really what we were trying to connote with our new name. And it's been a lot of fun with our rebranding process, which started last fall, and evolving from our original name, which was Legal Art.
And as you and I were talking about off mic, it clicks in South Florida on so many different levels. Other than the name change, what significant changes has your organization gone through in the past few years?
Well, when I think about our organization, I think about a rather simple question, and that is, what is needed in Miami to have a resilient and viable arts community? And the first thing that comes to mind is diversity and having a very healthy arts ecology by having a diverse spectrum of organizations and artists and basic infrastructure. So Cannonball plays a unique role in the local arts ecology, and our role is really to be responsive to the needs of cultural producers. You know, what do visual and performing artists, what do scholars, writers, designers need today to produce work, and to have long-lasting, sustainable careers. So over the past 10 years of the organization, you know, our platform of programming has reflected the needs of Miami's growing arts community. So we started by providing pro bono legal services, as you mentioned earlier, and most recently we launched an local and international residency program.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk more a little bit later about the various programs, wonderful programs you all provide. Tell me briefly about your board as our time is slipping away.
We have a small, courageous board, and, you know, like any nonprofit, the real strength of the organization starts with the board that has broad skill sets, anything from attorneys to artists and to people that really care about the arts and culture here in Miami. Mm-hmm.
Who might these great people be?
Well,
I'm going to put you on the spot here.
I could start with our board chair, and that is Daniel Arsham, who is a visual artist who cut his teeth here in Miami, and he now lives in New York. And from New York, he chairs our board and is one of our strongest advocates here in Miami. And we have a number of attorneys like Daniel Schwartz and Brian Heller that that help us out. The founder of the organization, Carolina, she is in Chicago.
She's still with you, great.
Yeah, and she's still – and she's on our board, and she runs her own arts nonprofit in Chicago.
Mm, wonderful. Sounds like a great group of people. So much to cover that we aren't going to do it all in this brief interview. So for more information, you can always go to cannonballmiami.org or call them directly at 786-347-2360. We're speaking with their executive director, Chris Cook. And Chris, let's dive quickly into the Live Work Residency Program. This is life-changing.
Absolutely. The program launched back in 2010 with a very generous grant from the Knight Foundation that enabled us to move into our first permanent facility, mm-hmm. where we have 7 live-work studios, and they are dedicated to Miami artists, but also artists that we bring in from all over the country. And each year we host anywhere from 15 to 20 artists, and they live and work here in Miami, ranging anywhere from 1 month to 3 months. And just yesterday, we announced our open call for applications for 2014. So right now, we are accepting applications from Miami artists and artists from around the globe that will participate in the program next year.
And that's open through August 12th, and selected residents will be notified by September. Good luck, one and all. You can get in touch on their website, once again, at cannonballmiami.org. Now, you've extended your services to the South Florida music community. Just 2 days ago, you had a wonderful legal workshop for Miami's music community called Monetizing Your Music. That's something new for Cannonball, isn't it? Is it not? Addressing music?
Absolutely. We have the Seminart series, which is a monthly program that we provide educational talks and discussions and workshops about a variety of issues. And this series is a new partnership between Cannonball and Sweat Records, which is a local indie music store. Mm-hmm. And at the end of every month, we host a program where attorneys talk about music issues within the music industry.
Vital information.
Absolutely.
I got to tell you. Yeah. Now, CSA, quickly in our last minute and a half. I'm sorry.
The Community Supported Art Program, that is a program that area artists are commissioned to produce new work that is available for purchase by anyone, and is a great way for emerging collectors to be introduced to Miami artists and to start building a collection of really important artwork.
Magnificent. You have launched your membership, and go online for more information. And let's wrap up with Mr. Chris Cook and Legal Link. You're still offering legal advice.
Absolutely. Every week we have artists calling us looking for advice. And typically it's on contract issues, intellectual property, or business formation. And we partner with the UM School of Law and area law firms to provide pro bono services to Miami's artists.
Our guest today to open up the show, Chris Cook, Executive Director of Cannonball, a terrific not-for-profit supporting South Florida artists. They're located in their big, beautiful building at 1035 North Miami Avenue, Suite 200 in Miami. And for direct contact, 786-347-2360, their website. And you're building a new one, I understand, cannonballmiami.org. Chris, thanks so much for catching us up with an incredible not-for-profit.
Thank you.
It's South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, jazz writer Bob Weinberg speaks with jazz musician and educator Gary Lindsay about the Miami Saxophone Quartet and their new CD, Four of a Kind. Chef Norman Van Aken returns with a word on food, and our Florida Keys calendar features Andy Newman with enticing event information. Up next, film critic Dan Hudak takes a look at what's new with Wynwood's independent movie house, O Cinema.
In April, I was invited to O Cinema to give a talk on Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece A Clockwork Orange as part of the theater's Kubrick retrospective leading up to the release of the Shining-related documentary Room 237. While all the art house theaters in South Florida have their own niche and feel, walking into O Cinema's Wynwood Theater, you're immediately hit with a burst of artistic energy. The exterior walls are exotically painted with bright colors, and inside one wall is a chalkboard where you're free to write whatever you'd like, and there are rooms with paintings and photographs from local artists. Accordingly, the programming at O Cinema is as eclectic as they come, ranging from family-friendly events to the straight-up bizarre and experimental. Co-founders Vivian Martel and Kareem Taps don't shy away from controversy either, as is evident with what's now playing in Wynwood, a documentary called Dirty Wars, about an investigative reporter's discovery of covert government operations that may threaten the lives of Americans.
I got a strange phone call. Someone from the inside was reaching out to me. Someone close to the heart of the president's elite force.
There are hundreds of covert operations on multiple continents. With the full support of the White House.
It's hard to say when this story began.
Greetings from Kabul, Afghanistan.
This was supposed to be the front line in the war on terror.
What's the name of this village out here?
But I knew I was missing the story. There was another war, hidden in the shadows.
We recently sat down with Kareem Tapsch to learn more about O Cinema's recent addition in Miami Shores and its approach to programming. Kareem, we know about the location in Wynwood. You're doing great there, but you also opened in Miami Shores October 2012. How are things going in the Shores?
Really well. It's so very exciting to be able to bring cinema back to Miami Shores after more than a 20-year absence. The community is really welcoming in, and we're getting a lot of people who want to see independent and foreign films coming from Aventura and Hollywood and North Bay Village, Miami Beach, and being welcomed with open arms, and we get to do more stuff.
Was this part of the plan all along to expand, and if so, why in the Shores?
We've always said that we are open to smart collaborations and partnerships that make sense. We actually approached the Miami Theater Center before we opened our Wynwood location looking for a temporary home and found out that there was an old law on the books in the Village of Miami Shores that outlawed movie theaters from being operating. So we pursued, continued with our Wynwood Theater and opening it and all of the work that that took. And all in the while, in the background, along with the Miami Theater Center, worked on repealing this law so that we could collaborate and open. So I guess you could say that, it's been in the plans from the very beginning. We've just been quiet about it.
So is it an extension of the Wynwood location? Are you doing different things there? Tell us more about it.
You know, it is an extension of what you come to expect with O Cinema, which is always, independent, foreign, and art films front and center. But it allows us to do a much more different style of programming. We bring a lot more foreign films, a lot of what I would call the larger New York Times approved kind of movies. And they're more accessible for a larger audience. While our Wynwood location still continues to be very edgy and definitely focused on what otherwise is not playing in South Florida. So we have an opportunity to broaden the kind of films that we bring to South Florida.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because last Friday night on the 21st, in the Shores, you were playing Hava Nagila, which was this nice Jewish-themed movie about Hava Nagila and how it's kind of transcended and changed its meaning through the years. And then in Wynwood, you're showing Human Centipede Part 1 and 2. And I don't even know if the FCC will allow us to say on the air what Human Centipede is about. Needless to say, people are connected in rather disturbing, horrific ways. So talk a bit about your programming there.
You know, I like to say that our programming is representational of our audience, which is quite eclectic in and of itself. We believe that there's all kinds of films that deserve audiences. And our Human Centipede back-to-back, if you will, is actually part of our Bizarro Cinema series. It's reimagining the midnight movies and presenting them every week in South Florida. So I guess you could say that, you know, we really believe that there's something for everyone, and we can't be everything for everyone, but we want to be a little something for the broadest possible audience and bring films that we think that they want to see and we think that they need to see.
And Human Centipede is a film that really brings people together.
It does. In the most disturbing way.
Okay. Speaking of food, Cine al Fresco comes from a grant. Tell us more about Cine al Fresco and how you're keeping it green.
Yeah, absolutely. We're thrilled to be the recipient of a grant from Art Place America, which is the largest organization in the United States for creative placemaking. And this grant is allowing us to convert our outside area into a sustainable green courtyard. We're going to be featuring native plants and host year-round programming of film and live events outdoors. It is, one, an extension of what we do as using cinema as a way to bring the community together. But two, specifically in Wynwood, we want more people to be outside. We want to bring the historic community that lives in the Wynwood area, along with those who come in to revel in the galleries and the art walk, bring them together, use film as a great equalizer, and encourage people to spend more time outside.
And what other improvements are you looking to bring to the Wynwood location?
We are a finalist for the Knight Foundation's Knight Arts Challenge. Of course, we were founded with a grant from the Knight Foundation, so they're big supporters of ours, and we are huge fans of theirs. Our grant, which we'll find out about in December, would allow us to do a complete overhaul of our technology, upgrading to DCP.
Hold on, DCP, for the uninitiated, talk to us.
DCP is the new universal format that has replaced 35mm. In order to be able to bring a broader scope of films, we have to incorporate DCP. With it comes a much greater visual experience, an upgrade of our sound to a 5.1 surround, a new and larger screen, and hopefully a second auditorium that will allow us to expand what we're doing and how many films we're able to bring in any given week.
Does that come with 4K resolution?
We haven't made a purchase of a projector just yet, so it might be 2K, it might be 4K, but it will be industry standard and really kind of we're going to be one of the handful of art houses in South Florida to have DCP.
That's exciting. DCP is going to open up so many more things that you could bring in and do so in a much easier, less bulky way than having reels of film that you have to splice together every week.
You know, we always have been digital, but this is kind of the next. This is the next step. This is the Rolls Royce of digital, if you will.
Yes.
And that's what we need, and that's what South Florida and our audience deserves.
Well, and improved. A dinner and a movie series. I mean, it sounds like a great idea. People are going on a date. They want to see something a bit different. Hey, dinner and a movie. It seemed perfect. They didn't just come to the theater.
We have a whole slew of special events that we do, but by far one of our favorite ones is our dinner and a movie. We've been partnering with Michael's Genuine, which is perhaps the greatest restaurant in the city, and it's an experience right all at O Cinema. You come and eat at an old-school cafeteria tray, some delicious food, and see a film in its premiere before it plays in South Florida. It's a really popular ticket. It's accessibly priced. We've also started doing a vegan dinner and a movie with a wonderful group called Love and Vegetables, and that's, of course, offering vegan meals along with films and fun times.
All right, last question. You are the New Times Reader's Choice for Best Art House Theater. Moving forward, what's one thing you would love to see happen?
I want everybody in Miami to experience independent cinema and know that there is a difference from what they're seeing at their neighborhood multiplex and what's coming out of Hollywood, that what's coming out of some of these great independent filmmakers across the country and the world, and realizing that movies are an art form that need to be appreciated and cultivated, and that O Cinema is leading the way.
Well, on behalf of movie fans in Miami, thank you for bringing it to us and making it available.
Appreciate it.
O Cinema is now open at its original location in the Wynwood Arts District, 90 Northwest 29th Street. and at its new spot at the Miami Theater Center in Miami Shores at 9806 Northeast 2nd Avenue. For more information, go to o-cinema.org or call 305-571-9970. For South Florida Arts Beat, I'm Dan Hudak.
Chairman Emeritus of the Florida Film Critics Circle, Dan Hudak, is a nationally syndicated film critic. You can visit him online at hudakonhollywood.com. O Cinema will be hosting a special one-night-only screening of Dirty Wars Saturday, June 29th at 8:30 at O Cinema Miami Shores, featuring Jeremy Scahill, the subject of Dirty Wars. He'll be talking about his experience and taking questions. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will continue in just a moment. Listening to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Chef Norman Van Aken joins us later on the program, and Andy Newman offers up his Florida Keys calendar. Jazz writer Bob Weinberg delves into the new release by one of South Florida's most distinctive and excellent jazz groups.
The Miami Saxophone Quartet can evoke a roaring big band one moment, a hushed chamber ensemble the next. For nearly 20 years, the group has put its silky signature harmonies to rich songbook selections spanning John Coltrane and John Cicada, Astor Piazzolla and Paul Simon, Pat Metheny and Jelly Roll Morton, and of course, numbers penned by its talented principal members. Comprising four of South Florida's top jazz horn players and educators, the MSQ has just released its fifth recording, the live concert document Four of a Kind. Captured on stage at the Gusman Concert Hall at the University of Miami, where group founder Gary Keller and chief arranger Gary Lindsay are longtime faculty members, the MSQ puts its unique stamp on classics by Duke Ellington and Dave Brubeck, as well as on a handful of Lindsay's dynamic compositions. The heated tenor leads are provided by the extraordinary Ed Calle, a two-time Latin Grammy winner and senior faculty member at Miami-Dade College, while the sonorous baritone sax comes courtesy of the exceptional Mike Brignola, a veteran of Woody Herman's thundering herd of the 1980s. The MSQ will celebrate the release of the new disc with a concert August 9th at the Bass Museum of Art on Miami Beach. We recently caught up with Gary Lindsay at the WLRN studios. Gary Lindsay, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here, Bob.
Great to have you. And, of course, congratulations on this brand new CD.
Thank you.
It's just fantastic. Four of a Kind. Live CD recorded in 2010 at UM Gusman Hall.
Yeah, and it was a combination of actually 2 years of concerts. 2010, I guess, 2011 concerts. We try to get to Gusman at least once a year to do something, and usually in January or late January. And so we were very happy with both concerts, and we decided, let's put it together. It's actually only the second live CD we've done.
That's right, going back to Miami Saxophone Quartet Live from 2003. Now, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the history of the band. How did you all come together?
Well, Gary Keller, who really is the person that started the group, he had been playing in a saxophone quartet for quite a while. I'm not sure how much further back from the Miami Saxophone Quartet that goes, but it was not really a jazz group. It was more of a classical group. And he had some students in it and had a few other local musicians playing in it. And he had the idea of, what about doing a saxophone quartet where we play predominantly jazz? And so he approached me, and to be honest with you, at first I was hesitant. I don't know, you know, I haven't been playing that much. I'm not sure if I could do it. I said, yeah, you got to do it. And you can write some music for it, too, you know. Maybe that's what enticed me a little bit, because I'd love to do that.
Sure.
So that was back in 2001. And we rehearsed every week for about 3 months before our first concert.
And the lineup has pretty much remained the same with you.
It's remained exactly the same.
Ed Kaye, Gary Keller,
and Mike Brignola.
Mike Brignola on the baritone sax.
The baritone, yeah. Yeah, it's remained exactly the same. It actually wouldn't work any other way, especially now that we've written so much music, because it's written for the personalities, written for the individuals.
Right. Well, I did want to ask you about that. You are the chief arranger and composer for the band, although each of the gentlemen, I believe, also contributes some compositions.
Yeah, Ed contributes a lot, but I probably have, at least lately, I've done the most because he's been more busy than I have in terms of being able to do other things. So I've contributed a lot. And when I first started doing it, it was kind of interesting, I think, because first of all, I teach jazz arranging at the University of Miami, and I talk about writing for saxophones every day, and I talk about rules of how to do it, and there needs to be parameters to teach someone how to write. So I have a lot of parameters, a lot of rules that the students have to follow to do it. Well, my idea when we started the quartet was, let's see how many rules I can break. And so I wanted to try to give it a little bit different style, because if you take four saxophones and you write them as a unit like you would hear in a jazz band, like on a saxophone solely, then there's a particular way of writing and everyone's basically playing the same rhythms in harmony, has a particular style to it. It doesn't work very well if it's all there is the four saxophones. If you don't have bass, piano, drums, anything else, it lacks something. So initially when we started the group, we had no intention of adding anything else to it, at least in the early stages of the group.
Right.
So I said, how do I keep the interest going and not make it sound like, oh, that's the saxophone section playing, but the rhythm section's missing?
Right.
So my idea was, I'm going to write it more like a string quartet. In a string quartet, one of the ways of writing for string quartet is a very contrapuntal four-voice kind of system. So that was the first idea that I had, was how am I going to make this different? Well, that's the first way. It's going to be much more contrapuntal, much more individual voices. And the energy and the rhythm is going to come from the activity of everyone, because there's no bass, there's no drums. It has to be generated. So it was generated through the activity in the counterpoint in the lines.
And can you tell us a little bit about some of your heroes when it came to arranging, some of the guys that you were looking to?
Well, I grew up, first of all, in the Maynard Ferguson era. My brother was a trumpet player, and he would bring home Maynard 60, Maynard 61, Message from Newport, which was a great era from Maynard Ferguson, if people out there don't know about it. But that whole early 60s era was really good. And so they had Willie Maiden, and they had Slide Hampton, a lot of different writers writing for him. So that's some of the first things that I really heard. Beyond that, I investigated the Woody Herman Band, and they had also great writers.
Right, and we also should talk about the four brothers, I guess, the four great reed players in that band.
Also
an influence on your writing. And
sure,
playing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I have one of the brothers in Mike
Brignola,
one of the later brothers. But so I knew the other players because we played gigs together, big band gigs, all different kinds of gigs. But when we got together as a quartet, as a chamber group, it was totally different. And I knew that one of the things you get when you get a chamber group is you get total exposure. There's no hiding anywhere.
Sure.
You can't hide. No rhythm section, no bass, no nothing to really fill up the space, so to speak. So I listened to the individual sounds of Mike and Ed and Gary, and it inspired me to write in this style more contrapuntal.
And also to allow them room to improvise as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah.
And how much were you influenced by, say, the cool school, like Claude Thornhill and Johnny Carisi, people like that who were, Jerry Mulligan, for instance, were they also in your mind in sort of that third stream mixing jazz and chamber music?
They were, although at the time I probably wouldn't have said that, but everyone that you just mentioned, you know, I listened to Jerry Mulligan and Paul Desmond, for instance, the duos that they would do, the Pianoless Quartet. Talk about counterpoint,
right.
Tremendous counterpoint. Actually, Paul Desmond was one of my heroes. And he was a guy that would play a melody, and then he would improvise, and the improvisation would be in the same level as the melody. It would be so amazing.
Did he make you want to play the alto
sax? Yes, he did.
First and foremost.
Yeah, he did.
And we should also mention Dave Brubeck, because I know that you delved into Blue Rondo a la Turk on a previous record, as well as It's a Raggy Waltz
right.
on this recording, as well as a previous
Yeah, we have a live version. This is one of the only, I guess probably the only piece that we recorded twice.
Yeah.
It's a Raggy Waltz. And interesting about that particular piece is it's what I call, it's called a recomposition. Because I took the melody and I used it as a departure point, but I allowed myself to move away from it when I felt it was right. So you hear some of the melody, quite a bit of the melody first. In fact, I stop by having the piano play the melody all the way through once. So it established, okay, yeah, this is Dave Brubeck's It's a Raggy Waltz. But then when the saxophones play it, they start playing the same, and then it deviates. And
sure.
You have to hear, you know, what happens to it.
And we should mention also that you do indeed have a wonderful rhythm section on this recording and previous recordings as well, mm-hmm. Mr. Jim Gazier, who also
Jim
is a
Gazier
great
is,
teacher.
Is one of my very favorite piano players. One of the things about Jim, first of all, he surprises me every time he plays. I'm listening to this journey. He creates great musical journeys. The other thing I've noticed about him, and especially listening to this new album, is that he plays differently on every tune. It's not like, okay, I'm going to plug in my solo on this tune, on this set of changes. When you listen to him on It's a Raggy Waltz, he quotes the tune. He uses some aspects of the tune intervallically. So it's like, yeah, he's playing through this tune, and now he's giving his own concept of it. And he does the same thing on all of them. He plays on Don't Look Back, and he plays on Lost and Found. And each one a different identity, because he takes the tune and really explores where that is going. So what he plays is more appropriate.
And we've also got Chuck Bergeron, a wonderful bass player, John Yarling on drums, mm-hmm. Brian Lynch, trumpet.
Yeah. In order, let's start with Chuck. Chuck is the unofficial fifth member of the quartet because he recorded with us and performed with us live more than anyone else. Talk about solid. You know, he's a tremendous player, great sound, great pitch. Very solid. He keeps us going. It's a trick to keep four saxophone players on their toes rhythmically. You got to really push, and he pushes us and keeps it going really well. John Yarling, same thing. Great drummer. He can do anything. He plays in the South Florida Jazz Orchestra, and we've had quite a few occasions for him to play with us, and it's always a pleasure. And now Brian Lynch. Brian Lynch is new to town. You know, Brian teaches at the University of Miami with Gary and myself. Tremendous trumpet player, just a really, really great trumpet player, and also a great arranger, by the way. There's a lot of things that people haven't heard yet from him, at least not in South Florida, but we hear them because we have jazz forums at school, so we have those mini concerts, and he's put on quite a few demonstrations of some amazing playing and writing.
Well, Gary Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us today on South Florida Arts Beat. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
The Miami Saxophone Quartet will perform from 7 to 9 p.m. Friday, August 9th, at the Bass Museum of Art on Miami Beach. For more information, please call 305-673-7530 or visit bassmuseum.org. For more information on the Miami Saxophone Quartet, visit miamisaxquartet.com. This is Bob Weinberg for South Florida Arts Beat.
Bob Weinberg is a writer and editor for Jazz Is Magazine and the online publication Jazz and Blues Florida. You can contact him at bobweinberg@mac.com. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will continue here on WLRN and WKWM in just a moment. To South Florida Arts Beat, Ed Bell with you. It's quite an honor for us to include the renowned chef Norman Van Aken on the show. Here's his segment, A Word on Food.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the frim-fram sauce with the aus and fade, with shafafa on the side. Shoot.
Hi, I'm Norman Van Aken, and welcome to A Word on Food. Today's word on food, café con leche. To me, each day begins the same way. It's want mixed with laziness, which strikes me as why a café con leche is so perfect. The want is the café. It is strong, primal, dark, and concentrated. The lazy is the leche, the milk, relaxing, passive, pure white, and life-giving. In the right ratio, you can find the way to enter the day and go forth. I have many memories of having cafe con leches in the little laundromats and sandwich shops of Key West. We made our own in our cozy rented homes as well, but I soon discovered there was a social aspect to having a con leche amongst strangers that heightened my appreciation for this blood-stirring and delicious beverage. The first place I remember having one was at the original Pepe's in Key West. I just ordered coffee, expecting the Java of my days in Illinois. Pepe's was a real shrimper's joint back then, and neither the staff nor the customers were the types to indulge an early morning quiz on why this coffee tasted so different than I expected. First off, I noted, the milk in it tasted odd to me. I ultimately realized that a number of the places still made their cafe con leches with tinned milk due to the very little fresh milk being available in the old days on the island, especially after the Depression and the hurricane of 1935. People got used to it that way and preferred it, even though fresh was now available. Also, the coffee was very sweet. When I finally asked why, I was given the counsel, because the sugar is sweeter in Cuba than it is here. Now that really rocked me. I thought sugar was sugar, like salt is salt. Now I know. The deep secret of a properly made cafe con leche is the sugar. Think about it. When you get coffee in most American places, the sugar, if even used, is offered after the coffee is made, on the side. To a Cuban, that's an insult. The sugar must go in with the just expressed coffee to caramelize the sugar on contact. That is the fusion moment, the magic kiss. When we were writing our latest cookbook, My Key West Kitchen, my son and co-author on this one, Justin, said, "Dad, we have to put in a recipe for a cafe con leche." I said, "Really? Don't you think folks will think we're being a bit simplistic?" But damn, he was right. I had to concede. Making a sugar coffee paste with a small steel pitcher and an espresso spoon combined with the first drops of espresso by stirring rapido is key. I love his words for it, so listen to what he advises. You should hear a swooshing clackety-clack sound as the spoon whips the cremita into an emulsion of coffee oils and sugar. With practice, you will recognize good cremita technique by this sound. Cooking by sound. I've used that notion in my cooking classes as well. But clackety-clack? Well, that is just genius. My son! Oscar Hijuelos wrote in his book, Our House in the Last World, "Who knows what caused the original love? Was it the taste of the tongue that had been sipping a creamy cafe con leche? Coffee isn't just coffee when it's a cafe con leche. It's the first kiss of the day. Enjoy the moment." I'm Norman Van Aken, and that's my word on food.
Norman Van Aken is the author of My Key West Kitchen and is also the director of restaurants for the Miami Culinary Institute and Tuyo in downtown Miami. Please tune in this coming Saturday morning at 8:34 on Weekend Edition to hear Hot Dog July 4th. And here's our South Florida Arts Beat entertainment calendar. And we say hello to Andy Newman of the Florida Keys and Key West Tourism Council. Andy, great to have you back with us.
And it's always great to be on your show.
I know there's something exciting going on in the beautiful, wonderful Florida Keys. What's up?
No, that's the fabulous Florida Keys to you, Andy. And you're absolutely right, because there's always something going on in the fabulous Florida Keys. So let's get right to it. Key West through July 31st. It is the Key West Art Garden. It's an opportunity to enjoy some large outdoor masterpieces. They're made by local artists, and they're all situated at the Key West Tropical Forest and Botanical Garden on Stock Island. Now, each piece is crafted from recycled materials and fits into the natural beauty and the backdrop of the gardens. Now, of course, Ed, next week, July 4th, Independence Day in the United States of America.
Oh, yeah.
And there is a cavalcade of activities down in the Florida Keys celebrating 4th of July. And so the 38th annual 4th of July parade that's themed American Heroes, That's in Key Largo, and that gets underway at 10 o'clock in the morning. It shuts down just a portion of US 1, just sort of blocking the northbound lanes for a couple of miles. But, of course, traffic will still flow on the other side of the highway, so no problem there. It starts at mile marker 98.2 on the center median of US Highway 1, ends at mile marker 100 in Key Largo. There's also an old-fashioned community picnic that's set from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Murray Nelson Government and Cultural Center, and then that evening, fireworks show on Blackwater Sound. Many more 4th of July events in the Keys. Alamorada, the fireworks and family fun at Founders Park, mile marker 87. It's the old-fashioned 4th of July celebration. It's hosted by the Village of Alamorada and the Upper Keys Rotary Club. Begins at 6 p.m. to 9:30 p.m., and of course, big fireworks show on Florida Bay will culminate that extravaganza. But we're not done yet for 4th of July because in Marathon at Sombrero Beach, it's a Marathon beach party and fireworks show. Kicks off with a parade around 10:30 in the morning that proceeds from Marathon High School to Sombrero Beach. This is right off mile marker 50 Oceanside, by the way. And, of course, it is a free admission, Sombrero Beach. There'll be a day-long celebration with food, drinks, craft entertainment, and, of course, again, capped off after dark with fireworks. Big Pine Key in the Lower Keys, the 4th of July fireworks celebration, and a big picnic. It'll be at Sugarloaf Airport, mile marker 17, Bayside on Sugarloaf Key. By the way, that's adjacent to the Corky Bat Tower. One day, Ed, we'll have to talk about that. But anyway, gates open at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. There'll be food, games, activities, and, of course, the 9 o'clock p.m. fireworks show. And then finally, down in Key West on July 4th, it is the 29th Annual Hospice Visiting Nurses Association July 4th picnic. It'll be staged at the Casa Marina Resort and Beach Club. That's located at 1500 Reynolds Street. The event will start at 5 o'clock. There'll be food and games and all kinds of activities. And, of course, the big fireworks extravaganza starts at 9 p.m., all organized by the Key West Rotary Club. One more event to talk about in terms of, even though it's not really July 4th, but you know what? We talk about what? American as apple pie.
Oh, yeah.
In the Florida Keys, it's American as key lime pie.
Love it, too.
And so July 4th through the 6th, it's the All-American celebration of Florida's official and one of the most tasty pies in the world, the Key Lime Festival in Key West. And one of the events on July 4th is going to be an opportunity to establish a world record for making the largest pie ever. I believe it's going to be some 15 feet in diameter. You're talking about thousands and thousands of slices of very tasty key lime pie. And then some other events coming up in July in the Keys. Big Pine in the Lower Keys. It's a Sugarloaf bike and paddle tour, an opportunity for outdoor adventures to enjoy a bit of on-road and off-road biking on Sugarloaf Key, and then followed by a paddleboarding on the water through subtropical mangrove forest. Very, very cool. July 10th in Key Largo, the Reef Environmental Education Foundation will be presenting another in its free lionfish collecting and handling workshops. Now, lionfish, Ed, they're a non-native species to the Keys, and in fact, the entire Caribbean, and they are an invasive species. They shouldn't be here. We've got to get rid of them to help protect our native species. The only way to get rid of them is to hunt them and to eat them. And they're good eating. If you're used to hogfish, snapper species, they taste a lot like hogfish.
I must say, delicious.
Absolutely. Now, Ed, let's go down to Key West, July 11th to the 14th, for the Mel Fisher Days,
Ooh.
An annual celebration. It brings together the fans of this very famous Key West treasure hunter, and they're still recovering treasure every day. Up the Keys a little bit, Big Pine in the Lower Keys, one of the great events of the year for the Keys. It will be the 29th annual Underwater Music Festival. It is a quirky concert that's broadcast underwater for divers, snorkelers. You know what? We've seen Elvis underwater, Ed. I'm telling you, snorkeling Elvises, it's a great event. The music is specially programmed for that underwater listening experience. Now, this event, besides having a lot of fun, and yes, people come down and they wear costumes and we bring instruments underwater and they dance underwater, But there's a serious side of it, because interspersed between the music are coral reef preservation and conservation messages. They serve as public service announcements to remind us to protect the coral reef. And then, Ed, we go back to Key West, the opportunity to celebrate Key West's adopted son, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Ernest Hemingway. It's the annual Hemingway Day celebration. This is the 33rd annual celebration of the legendary author's work and also his fun-loving Key West lifestyle. It's July 16th to the 21st. There will be literary readings. There will be a theatrical premiere, a short story competition, the Drambuie Key West Marlin Tournament, and, of course, the annual look-alike contest, that Hemingway look-alike contest that's staged every year at Sloppy Joe's Bar. For more information on these and so many other events in the fabulous Florida Keys, just go to the Keys website. It's flakeys.com.
Andy Newman of the Florida Keys and Key West Tourism Council always brings us exciting event information. And thank you so much, Andy. Great weekend.
Have a great weekend to yourself, too.
And there's a party tonight at the Wolfsonian FIU. It's Free Fridays. The Wolfsonian FIU, located at 1001 Washington Avenue on Miami Beach, has their free evening every Friday from 6 to 9 p.m. Tonight they feature a free guided tour of their two exhibitions, including Modern Meals, Remaking American Foods from Farm to Kitchen, and Women in Motion, Fitness, Sport, and the Female Figure. For more information, go to thewolf.fiu.edu or call 305-531-1001. There's a party tonight from 6 to 9 at the Wolfsonian. Students, don't forget, CultureShockMiami.com is your pass to the arts, where you can buy inexpensive tickets to music, theater, museums, festivals, dance, and more, such as events at the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center and the Miami-Dade County Auditorium, tomorrow night featuring the Cuban Classical Ballet of Miami. Visit CultureShockMiami.com for more information. And we'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 o'clock on our WLRN Extra HD channel. You can tune in on your HD radio or go to our website at WLRN.org for more information. And that's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. Adrian Kennedy is our executive producer. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Paul Leary is our social media editor. Special thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner, and our contributor, Dan Hudak, Bob Weinberg, Norman Van Aken, and Andy Newman. We'd like to hear from you. Please call us with your comments, 305-995-2258. You can fax us your event information to 305-995-2221 or email it to us at info@wlrn.org. We'd like to hear from you. Of course, Monday, Topical Currents with hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend. Please keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy.